Welcome to The Current, a podcast produced by We Stand for Energy. We Stand for Energy is a community that supports a reliable, affordable, and sustainable energy future for everyone, and is a project of EEI, the National Trade Association representing U.S. investor-owned electric companies. My name is Brad Viator, Vice President of External Affairs at EEI, and I'm your host.
Welcome back, everyone. We're coming up on LIHEAP Action Day on February 23rd. So we're going to have a conversation about LIHEAP. And for those of you experts, those of you that have been tuning in for our podcast for a while, you've heard us talk about LIHEAP a bit. And LIHEAP is the Low Income Home Energy Assistance Program. And it's a really great program that figures out how to get money to people who need help paying their energy bills. And there's always a fight on Capitol Hill about funding levels with the LIHEAP program. And then there's sometimes a fight in distributing those monies at the state and local level. So today I've got two guests who know quite a bit about the program and can share what's going on with LIHEAP. I'm joined by Katrina Metzler, who is the executive director of the National Energy and Utility Affordability Coalition. Welcome, Katrina.
Thanks, Brad.
And I'm also joined by another expert who has had quite the career working on these issues at the county and now at the state level, Teresa Cullen, who is the LIHEAP manager for the state of Colorado, and she sits in the Colorado Department of Human Services. Welcome, Teresa.
And thanks, Brent.
All right, Katrina, I'm going to start with you. We got a LIHEAP Action Day coming up on February 23rd. Can you talk a little bit about what LIHEAP Action Day is and why it's important?
Sure thing. LIHEAP Action Day is one day a year when we coalesce support for the low-income home energy assistance program at the federal level and try to connect policymakers with people at the grassroots level, at utilities and nonprofits that implement this program, to connect them on the issue of energy affordability. So we direct the conversation to talk about things that are happening at the local level that could affect federal policy with regards to the LIHEAP program. And it's just so critically important that we have those conversations, because policymakers, without that information, they can be disconnected from what's happening at the local level. So that's the impetus of the day. We have record-breaking attendance this year. We have nearly 300 people who will be joining us virtually for LIHEAP Action Day this year. And we have more than 300 meetings scheduled on the Hill. So it's going to be a big turnout. And I can't think of a more important time for us to be having a day like this and meeting with our legislators and detailing for them what we're seeing at the local level among their constituents.
So, Katrina, you were one of my first guests on The Current when we launched our podcast back in 2020. And at that time, the conversation was about, oh my gosh, COVID, it's crazy. We have so much need everywhere. People are out of work, and particularly restaurants were closed, and people that were in the service industry were in a very tight spot. And so programs like LIHEAP became critically important. And I think, frankly, your coalition was very successful in getting good amounts of funding as a result of that. Can you tell our audience a little bit about what's happened with LIHEAP and any sort of lessons learned from dealing with the pandemic?
Oh gosh, where to start, Brad? It's been a whirlwind couple of years. And I definitely recall the last time that we were together talking about the not knowing factor, you know, what's going to happen to people? How much energy need will we see? What kind of results are we going to see in energy bills and in arrearages based on the moratoria that were being implemented at that time? Now, 2 years into the pandemic, we know what's happening. We have a pretty good handle on what kind of need there is out there. And we also know that recovery happens last and most slowly for the vulnerable families that we serve. So while the nation might be making an economic recovery, we know that's happening much more slowly for our families. They're still trying to dig out of the hole. So LIHEAP, and we're enjoying historic levels of funding right now. And again, that is in large part due to the advocacy of our members. We're so grateful to have those folks coming to the Hill, like for LIHEAP Action Day, making sure that that message is delivered loud and clear about the need that they're seeing in their communities. But we're learning some things too throughout the pandemic. We learned that 27,000 children, for example, were lifted out of poverty because of LIHEAP in 2020. That was the CARES Act money and the regular LIHEAP funding that Congress appropriated. But it's been a struggle. And I think the thing that is most positive has been the improved partnership between utilities and nonprofits. In some places, those were already strong partnerships, but in places where those folks didn't necessarily talk to one another on a regular basis, COVID has been the trigger that creates a new relationship at the community level between utilities and their nonprofit partners in order to perform effective outreach and make sure we're hitting the right families. There are a lot of new families who have never been eligible for LIHEAP before, don't know that these funds exist, don't know how to access them, and don't think that they're for them. So identifying those families through the utility side of things has been really helpful in outreaching to them and making sure that they know that these funds are for them too. I think that's one of the positive things that's come out is the strength in partnerships that we're seeing across the country.
Teresa, I'm going to ask you a similar question, actually, from your perspective, having worked for years at the county level at LIHEAP, now working for the state of Colorado on this issue. What have you seen? How have things changed from 2018 when you started with the state to post-pandemic?
I think the game has really changed. When everything started to shut down and county offices were closing, people weren't going out, we had to figure out how we could get applications into people's hands and ensure that they could turn them in somewhere. So we implemented telephone applications. We met with our call center. We said, hey, how do we do this? They ran with it. And we had a platform for a telephone application so that anyone that was homebound. So there's a barrier that we faced. And we have continued to do, and we will never take that option away. It is really serving the needs of those that are homebound anyway and face application barriers. We have gone to training, our statewide training, via virtual platform. So we're able to engage more people in our training that way. And if people struggle through a class, we're offering 5 a year virtually. So through the whole thing, it has just been being creative. How do we reach the people? How do we ensure their needs are being met?
Brad, I'll jump in here and say, speaking of really positive things that have come out of this experience, Teresa just gave a couple of really great examples of permanent program improvements as a result of the pandemic. That's the reason why we implemented these changes, and we have things like phone applications available or online applications, but those are going to become permanent mainstays of our program now. So our program has upped its game and improved overall as a result of figuring these things out and being creative.
I think LIHEAP received some historic level of funding in the American Rescue Plan last year, and I think that's good, clearly, because there's a lot of need that's out there. Were there any adjustments made to whether state agencies can spend money on overhead and new programs? Was that a part of it? Because y'all are very flexible in figuring everything out, but can money be allocated to improve the distribution?
So LIHEAP is governed by some federal statute regulations that we can't change. And one of those is the administrative level for the program. It remains 10%. That did not change through COVID. However, as our funding appropriation increased, that 10% value increases as well. So it does help us to gear up and staff up as needed for COVID-19. I don't think there's a person listening to my voice and you're part of our network who would agree that is enough to run a really effective program in 2022. The administrative level for the program hasn't changed in 40 years. And, you know, we celebrated the 40th anniversary of LIHEAP in 2021. It's probably time. And those are things that we're discussing with our federal partners on the Hill to see if that's a possibility. There's some legislation that's been proposed that wants to increase that to 15%. There's a chance that that'll happen. But in the meantime, the existing flexibility that LIHEAP gives us is proving to be so valuable. And state directors are becoming very savvy about how to mine that flexibility in order to address concerns with COVID-19. They're figuring it out. These are folks like Teresa who are creative. They figure it out. And that's what's happening at the local level right now.
Teresa, I'm going to turn to you. Can you tell the audience about the Colorado LEAP program, the Colorado Low Income Energy Assistance Program, what it is, how it works, and who's eligible?
So the Colorado program provides assistance with the winter heating expenses. So we're considered a cold weather state. And in order to meet eligibility requirements, a federal block grant has 16 assurances that we have to meet in order to administer the program. So people have to meet income guidelines. People have to be vulnerable to rising heat costs, meaning that they pay a heat bill to their landlord or their heating vendor, their heat's in their rent. They have to be responsible to pay heat costs. We need to have at least one eligible household member in any LEAP eligible household, meaning that at least one person has to meet U.S. citizenship or residency requirements. You need to meet those criteria. We set our benefits at a minimum benefit level and a maximum benefit level. We have a benefit matrix, and depending on what your heating costs are and your living arrangements helps govern what your benefit amount is. And once the math calculation is complete, your benefit level actually would come out to less than $250. You get a minimum payment of $250. And the maximum up to $1,000 and anything in between, depending on where you fall. And we have to take the income into consideration when determining the benefit level, because we have to ensure that we are distributing the funds to the households with the highest energy costs and the lowest income.
One of the things that I hear often from people that work on LIHEAP is there's some stigma associated with it, and people don't realize that they're eligible, and then they're apprehensive about applying to it because they think of it like an us and them sort of situation. Can you explain a little bit about the success, the number of people that you're able to serve, and whether that's on a growth trajectory, and then how you try to reach those folks that are out of reach?
Our program in Colorado has been on a growth trajectory for the last, I would say, 4 years. Incrementally seeing smaller increases in the number of applicants. Once COVID hit, we started seeing like 5% and then 7%. And now that pandemic unemployment has ended, we're seeing a 10% increase this year. So as you see increases every year, and then you start to see big increases, that adds up to tens of thousands of households. And we've worked really hard to be creative and strategic in Colorado. One of the challenges in Colorado is we have the big metro areas, and there's lots of advertising opportunities, TV interviews, that sort of thing. But when you get into the rural mountainous communities and you're dealing with folks that really see any type of public assistance program as very daunting, and we have a lot of mountainous folks that try to live off the grid. So I'm trying to gauge them in actually applying for a program that can really, really help them has been a challenge. So we have over the years changed our strategies on marketing and how we reach those rural communities. Some of our most vulnerable population is our seniors, and they are old school. You don't need to ask for help. I'll turn my thermostat down to 58 and wear my winter coat and sit under three blankets because we don't apply for help from any government agency. So it's been a battle. One of the things in Colorado, and I think in every state now, Colorado's never required you to come into the office and have a face-to-face interview. And people feel very embarrassed by going into an office and asking for help. So that stigma is not attached to our program. People apply by mail, by telephone, by computer, so they can apply and not have to be out front and center showing their face that they're in need of help. But it doesn't change the mindset. If you know anybody that even might think that they might qualify, apply for the program, apply for the benefits. We're here to help.
Absolutely. Katrina, I might ask this question to you to go back to the American Rescue Plan and funding levels from last year. How big was the increase? What was LIHEAP funded at initially, and then what is it funded at now?
We were at $3.8 $5 billion prior to the pandemic. And with American Rescue Plan funding and the regular LIHEAP, we're at well over $8 billion right now, and still not enough to address the need. And I think you'll hear that across the board. There are other programs out there as well that we're coordinating with on the housing side to provide some assistance for utilities. One of the things that programs struggle with are different requirements and different reporting that's required for each individual federal program that comes down the line. So those local agencies, LIHEAP directors are kind of like maestros, and they're pulling from funding that makes sense for each customer and kind of meeting them where they're at with what their needs are and what they're eligible for in their community, and making sure that they've connected them with the right resource. It's just another layer of challenges for them, but it does give us extra resources and in a time when they're sorely needed. I know that we're really grateful to have the opportunity to pull from these other funds. If this doesn't work, maybe this will work. And it's also strengthened, again, relationships between state partners in housing and state partners in energy affordability. So that's been helpful. We've had to sort of reimagine LIHEAP. We did things like expand eligibility. We streamlined requirements and things like asset tests, which is how many assets do you have to your name and counting that as an income qualifier. Those were dropped in a lot of places during the pandemic. Supplemental benefits were added for eligible households that continued to carry arrearages. We invested in weatherization and energy efficiency, and we had a record-setting expansion of cooling programs. We helped 1.2 million households in 2020 with cooling assistance. And we'd like to see that expansion continue. So these additional resources are giving us the ability to help people with a deeper benefit, to help more households across the board. That's how we're spending these additional resources.
So if I can ask, the $3.8 billion you said over eight, and it's still not meeting the need, what do you estimate the need to be?
That's the million, maybe billion dollar question, Brad. we get asked this all the time. Right now, the program is able to serve with current resources of around $4 billion. We can serve around 5 to 6 million households a year. So if you do the math, anywhere from 17 to 20 billion, if we wanted to serve every single household, but that doesn't tell us everything. There's so much nuance in this story about the other assistance that's available to those households and the people who aren't telling us that they're in need, the hidden pockets of need, like Teresa was discussing in some of those mountain communities, rural need. So that's our best guess, but it is really just an estimate. And the federal government just can't provide all resources. That's why across the country, you see fuel funds, for example, stepping up, either grassroots fuel funds that are nonprofits that have just come out of the need, like the Coalition to Keep Michigan Warm, the Maryland Fuel Fund, the Dollar Energy Fund, Energy Outreach Colorado, so many of these, literally just in response to helping to meet the excess need that can't be provided by the federal government in LIHEAP. Utilities step up with Roundup programs, and they've introduced programs through their own utilities and through their customer base to help folks with their bills. It's all hands on deck right now, and everyone is coming to the table with whatever resources they have available to them to make it work.
To go back to a point that was made earlier about the percentage of funding that can be used for administrative costs, I just remember that befuddling experience after you got increased funding levels for LIHEAP. And we were having conversations internally at EEI and among utilities about how much money can actually physically be distributed through the agencies. And there were limitations on that. And it wasn't for lack of funds that were available. It was that the program, there weren't the appropriate number of program managers, and there wasn't the programmatic resources to push those dollars out the door. So when you start to talk about a program that has been prepped for $4 billion is now moving to $8 billion and the need could be as high as 20. To me, it seems pretty important that some of those structural adjustments are made at the agencies that are distributing that cash so we don't deal with this befuddling problem again. I don't know, Teresa, what do you think?
Well, I tell you, I just had this conversation last week with one of the Colorado senators, and right now we're still in survival mode, dealing with pandemic changes, but they were asking about what's your biggest barrier to serving people. And I did bring up the fact that 10% administrative costs limits any ability to be creative with the money that we have and inventive and strategic, because you're just running on a shoestring all the time. And you've got to watch every penny that you spend on your admin when everything now is automated and computerized. When the program started back in the 80s, everything was done on paper. And now maintenance of computer systems alone is tens and tens of thousands of dollars a year, and the support you need to run your systems. And it's just getting more difficult to administer the program within those parameters. And the other obstacle, as Katrina mentioned, the funding right now is at levels that is totally unprecedented. And when that extra funding goes away, then we have to pare down our program, cut benefits, because we have managed to be successful in increasing our enrollment, but then we're back to old funding levels. So great, we have more people on our enrollment, which we want. But the benefits are going to be less because the funding doesn't support that high level of a caseload.
That's an excellent point. And also why the face that you put on LIHEAP at LIHEAP Action Day, why it matters so much, right? Because if you're a policymaker, you're just over there going, what's the problem? We just doubled your budget. Like, oh, you want more money for government largesse so you can get a better paycheck? Hearing the nuance and the specifics about what the money's being used for, how families are impacted, it's so important to policymakers, right? They have to see someone in flesh and blood through a screen to express this stuff to them.
Brad, I wanted to give you a quick example. I was speaking with a LIHEAP director in Missouri who told me that he has one staff person for about every 1,000 LIHEAP applications that come in. And Teresa spoke a little bit to the depth of the requirements in an application for a federal assistance program. They are considerable because you're using federal taxpayer money. And so we're accountable for those funds. And I always used to tell my clients when I worked at the local level, nothing comes for free. You're right. The price you pay is in paperwork. And I've got a lot of it here for you. You know, we're going to get through this together. But yes, there's a lot of paperwork. So that gives you some idea of what happens in the field and how strapped people are.
Yep. All right. I'm going to ask an unfair question. If you get to boil it down to one thing that you need from the program to put you in position to distribute more of these resources to needy people, what is it, Katrina?
Oh, gosh. So I hope I don't steal Teresa's answer, because really my answer is inspired by a conversation that I had with her where we were talking about specifically supply chain issues and how LIHEAP might be the only program in a state where if your grandma's furnace goes out in the middle of winter and she's on a fixed income, you know, we can go out and replace it. The cost to do that has increased because of supply chain issues. The cost to weatherize homes and the insulation that we used to do so has increased. So while we have more money, it stretches less far with the cost of things right now. And I look at this $8 billion level and then dropping back down to a $3.85 billion level. And I worry about that steep decline, that people will fall off the edge of the cliff, sort of to speak to Teresa's point again. I think if I had one thing that I could ask for, it's a more gradual step down. I'm hoping that Congress maximizes funding at $5.1 billion. It's the most we can ask for in a regular program year cycle, so that we have an opportunity to step down a little more gradually and don't go from 80 to 0 miles per hour. Also, we don't upend the lives of our staff people. You know, we've had to staff up for these levels of funding, and now just dropping all those staff at once after we've trained them and got them really good at their jobs, and now we're going to drop them. Just all of those types of considerations and maximum funding level, that's what I would ask for.
What about you, Teresa? Did she steal your answer?
She did steal a little bit of my thunder. I will say I am amazed at the increase in costs of our furnace repair and replacement program, just solely based on supply chain issues and having to take steps backwards. We have easily doubled the funding that we have put into furnace repair and replacement. The need has skyrocketed, obviously, with the lower income populations that live across the state. And it's not just our program. It's every single solitary thing that people's lives are involved in. Food, gas, rent. And right now we're able to meet those needs, but it's frightening to think when the level of funding goes down that we're still going to be able to deliver the same services that we can now. And that's what's scary.
Teresa, Katrina, I appreciate you talking to me about this critically important program from two folks who are on the front lines. Thanks so much.
It's a pleasure being here. Thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you, Brad. Appreciate it.
We hope you found this to be an informative 15 minutes, and we look forward to bringing you additional expert insights on energy policy. To learn more about EEI and the electric power industry, visit www.eei.org. You can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts by searching for The Current and We Stand for Energy.